It's Wednesday, September 27, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Jared Schroeder. On our program this week, a tentative deal in the writers' strike. It's a win for the WGA, but the actors, nothing there yet. The actors still working on a deal. It's the real-life succession. Rupert Murdoch is stepping down as the chairman of Fox and News Corp come November. What does that mean for the future of the company? And the Google antitrust trial. We're going to talk about the court watchers there every day and why the Department of Justice has pulled some documents from public view. But first, I can't believe this is our lead story this week. It was going to be our kicker, the thing we talked about before signing off. But no, too many people around here told me I was missing the point. So let's talk about it. We are really, really going to talk about them. Travis Kelce and his biggest fan, Taylor Swift.
Trailer.
Did yeah. I say trailer?
No,
oh, no,
did
the,
not.
They are trailer. Yes. See, I don't even trust the words coming out of my own mouth today. If you don't know by now that Taylor Swift was in the skybox watching the game with Kelce's mom, you have to be hiding under a rock somewhere. I mean, it has been everywhere. It's been on TV, on social media. The Wall Street Journal. Yes, even the Wall Street Journal decided that this story was worth ink. And I guess the big question here, Kathy, is why? What even makes this newsworthy?
Well, I'm going to say, coming from a football family, it is so refreshing to see a woman dominating the NFL news. It's so that may be part of it. But it's our version.
One of the referees in Sunday's game was a woman. She didn't dominate.
No way.
Okay.
Well, that's what
that
I'm saying. It takes a special kind of woman.
Yeah.
And so I think really this is like our version of royalty. You know, you saw all the excitement over a royal wedding. These are two mega celebrities. Taylor a little bit more mega than an NFL tight end, but still he's a pretty big deal in Kansas City. And so you see two very famous celebrated people getting together, and we just can't resist it. It's catnip.
I think we know this story all too well. The joke only works if you know her songs.
Okay, well, yeah. And so there are a whole bunch of people, but see, yeah. I don't know all of her songs. We talked
the
about that
work,
on this program.
The joke were with my students yesterday, apparently.
Did it? Well, and frankly, it was a bunch of students who told me, in addition to Travis McMillan, our director, that I was maybe missing the news here, that this is a whole lot bigger than it might seem on the surface, that we have the news value of proximity, mm-hmm. that we're also talking about Travis Kelce being on the Kansas City Chiefs. He's the local guy, the local team, their prominence, the two of them, the conflict, the idea that, you know, she's had one or two boyfriends who have been the source of breakup songs, mm-hmm. that perhaps one day there will be another. One of the things that was really interesting to me about this is how many times we've talked about everybody who needs the NFL. We talk about the TV networks need the NFL, that brands need the NFL, that that's where they get some of their biggest opportunities for advertising. And it was interesting that at the end of a week where almost every sports journalist covering football in the country was trying to figure out why Andrew Williams so quickly and so secretly left the Chicago Bears, that game where the Bears were on the field and Andrew Williams wasn't, the NFL had a new storyline here where they could change the narrative and suddenly turn all the attention to Taylor Swift.
Well, but I will say this. I don't think that was the NFL's doing. I'm sure they were very happy about it for reasons such as the one you stated. But this was, I think, organic. I mean, we've talked about the incredible interest in Taylor Swift concerts. She is a genuine celebrity, a cultural phenomenon. And there she is at a football game, just like us, at a football game. And so I think that's kind of irresistible. But I want to hear more about the joke.
Oh, the All Too Well joke. I was just trying to work in her song. The best part was the students in my class were worried that she would break up with Travis Kelce right before the Super Bowl and sabotage the Chiefs' chances. Multiple students independently said they were concerned about that. Isn't that funny?
That is kind of
like
funny.
She does have this long record of, you know, the relationship's not going well.
Paranoid.
So this is a new type, but we'll get a different kind of song out of this, I think, that we've not done an athlete before.
No, we haven't. Yeah. The other thing too, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, Jared, the economic effect and impact that Taylor Swift can have. We talk about the NFL needing Taylor Swift. A lot of these NFL stadiums where she may or may not follow her beau or her possible beau to go watch football, these are stadiums she was selling out all summer and places where the NFL teams themselves aren't selling out those venues.
The Kelce jerseys were up 400% yesterday in their sales. Isn't that incredible? Of course, if they break up, there'll probably be some kind of public burning of them or something. Like, it goes both ways. You're playing with fire.
I see. Okay, wow. We are already anticipating a breakup, and we don't even know the romance is official.
That's not fair.
This is really, I don't know. This is very paranoid. But anyway, let's hope that the young love survives.
Okay, we'll watch. And it will probably continue
and
to
we'll
be
know
a story.
All about it because
it
it'll
will.
Be on the news.
Just
we
like
absolutely
it was this
will,
morning, leading the 9 o'clock hour on the Today Show.
The spectacle's just too big.
Yes.
Can't be not watched.
Sunday night, there was another big story that broke. The Writers Guild of America reached a tentative agreement with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. Now, it's a tentative agreement that was agreed to in principle. And earlier today, the writers went back to work between Sunday and today. It was just the idea that the picketing was going to stop. But now it seems the lawyers have hammered out that language. So this is great. They're going to go back to work. The writing is going to start again. We've talked about Drew Barrymore and some of the drama around her. We're coming back. We're not coming back. Like, now she'll be able to come back next week. Here's the thing, though. Who are they writing for? Because the actors don't have a deal yet.
Well, they're writing for really the shows that you mentioned. And I just saw a headline before I came in that a number of these talk shows, the comedy shows are coming back because the writers are there. But you're right, the actors are still out. And but this, I think, is really part of, I think it's really interesting news because it comes the same week that you had the really unusual spectacle of a president of the United States walking a picket line. And I think when you look at both of those things, the auto workers strike, and then what the writers' settlement, which really it looks like they got pretty much what they asked for, and the actors still saying out, I think this is part of a larger phenomenon. It's really pushing back against a trend that started at least as early as the 80s when collective bargaining and labor movements were really kind of in bad odor. People weren't joining unions. And I think, I've said this before, I'll say it again, I think the disparity in income, you're really starting to see a pushback against the idea that people at the very top of a corporate heap are making multi exponentially times what the people at who are the worker bees are making. And I think that's what we're seeing here. And it's interesting that the actors are holding out, and it'll be interesting to see how much they get.
I think the other domino will fall. Like, that some of the actors' concerns are similar to the writers' concerns, so you would think some of the template that was already made could be reused for them. So I wouldn't be surprised if they got it back together pretty soon, too. But it really is interesting, your point about all the different labor movements going on right now. I think technology is also pushing that, especially with this for the for both groups, because the automation for auto and then the AI for actors and writers are both pushing that as well. So there's definitely the disparity. That's a great point. But I also think the technology is pushing them. They're concerned about their future. And that's really interesting they've included that. And the news coverage has been really interesting because they've really focused on popular opinion in the stories I've read. So they'd be like, you know, like you said, unions have slid in membership and in power, and a lot of court decisions have gone against them. But here, they've got a lot of public support. The actors, the writers, all the polls show a lot of sympathy for the auto workers, which gives them extra power
and
in their labor.
And you have the two leading presidential candidates siding with the auto workers. Biden marched on the picket line yesterday. Trump is visiting them this evening rather than going to the second Republican presidential debate. So two people who are pretty ideologically opposite, both taking the same side in this fight.
But Trump's speaking at a non-union plant.
Well,
that's true.
But Trump's trying. Yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. But they will both be there, yeah.
So, Jared, I'm glad that you're here with us this week as one of the new faculty members joining us this academic year. You're a legal scholar, and we're going to talk about a couple of legal and policy issues. One of those is what's going on in the Google antitrust trial, because this trial is now in its third week, but it's been really secretive in how this trial has gone on. And interestingly enough, the Department of Justice pulling down some once public documents that had been entered into this case, not visible to the public anymore.
Yeah, that's not good. It's not cool.
And it's not common. Why would they agree to do this? This is something that was at Google's request.
All I can think of is that there's a concern that they will not be able to get the full set of facts for the trial, and they don't want to have any question about whatever is resolved. That in an effort to ensure a fair trial for Google, they're willing to sacrifice public knowledge about what's going on.
That really stinks.
And it really does. Yeah. One of the other things that I found to be interesting in this case is that Apple and Microsoft were going along with Google in these arguments to get these documents taken down, almost kind of previewing, like predicting what might be ahead for them in trying to protect themselves.
You know, one of the most powerful powerful tools, I think, in a lawyer's playbook, and Jared can talk more about this, but it is the discovery process in a trial. And I think that's what was going on here, that just by going to trial, and this is why a lot of cases get settled before trial, you are going to have to disclose a lot of information about your business practices that will not necessarily be flattering. And I think the issue with Google or Apple or any of the major internet platforms or people who use data as the basis of their business is they've got a lot of information on us. When you talk to most of our students, they talk about the free services they get, but of course we're paying with our data, and it's really scary how that data has been used to not only affect the advertisements you get, but increasingly to affect the news you get. And I think it has had an impact on polarization worldwide. And I think that's what a lot of this discovery could potentially go to. And the big boys don't want it. And it's distressing, I think, to see the government caving.
Your comment about the discovery made me think, so the Fox Dominion decision, that the defamation case that came out last spring, that they settled, but right before trial, so discovery happened. And the comments that they had, the text messages and the emails, were what decided that situation. The situation where they said, you know, Tucker Carlson said this, but then he said this on the air, showing, so maybe they're trying to avoid that sort of thing. And yeah, we don't realize how big Google is. Like, we think, oh, Google, it's adorable. We use our search engine for it. It's so great. But it's also YouTube, which mm-hmm. is a powerful, divisive tool. A lot of research has shown that YouTube is very powerful in leading people down extreme rabbit holes.
Yes. Oh, there's a story in the Washington Post today about how YouTube is fomenting ethnic violence in India. It's horrible. The idea that the problem is that these publishing platforms have been given an out. They don't have the incentive to police their space in the same way that a newspaper or a television station or radio would have, because there's no libel that can affect these platforms. And you know, I think that was at the time in 1996 when that was enacted, and these were all garage bands. Maybe it made sense, but it's a very different world now.
Wow. We don't have time for Section 230 during this episode.
No.
Don't get me started. Let's save it for, we could do one special issue on that.
Okay. So instead of getting you down the section,
let's do another rabbit hole.
I'm going to take you down another rabbit hole that I know is one of your favorites. And this is one that broke late yesterday afternoon, that the FCC is set to try to reinstate net neutrality. That's the set of rules that state internet service providers must treat all traffic equally, that they can't slow down speeds or access to their own
competitors.
Product, right. I wrote it as their own product, so yeah. I had that backward. I'm telling you, I'm having a week. But that they can't slow down competitors or give preferential access to their own products or those with which they have business partnerships. This is a big deal, Jared. It was put in place in 2015, repealed during the Trump administration. Some of us are saying, wait, it's almost 2024. Yeah. How is it just now coming back?
Yeah, I remember the way I teach my classes, I tend to hit net neutrality right around November.
Okay.
And so in November 2020, I was almost waiting for the election to decide if I was going to include net neutrality or just let it go. Because if Trump won a second term, it would be another 4 years and it would just be gone. Net neutrality would be gone. But Biden won, so I was like, okay, I'll keep it in the class. And I was waiting, and the next semester came, and the next. So basically the short version is we were waiting for the FCC to have a full five members. The way the FCC works is there must be three members from the president's party and two from the other party. And we've been waiting to get the last one confirmed because Congress, not only has Congress failed to write anything about net neutrality into a law, which is part of the problem, so it switches every time we have a president change or party change, but they also failed to get the final member on until just recently. So now, with a three-person majority, 3-2 majority, the FCC can now reinstate net neutrality.
So basically, they got the votes.
They've got the votes until the next election, which isn't that far away, and then we'll see.
And I think it's also fair to point out that there are tremendous interests that can affect Democrats as well as Republicans, major companies that are opposed to net neutrality. And so I don't think you can guarantee, I mean, money talks. And I think this is, and that's probably one reason we're not seeing Congress act. There are some major financial players, deep pockets, trying to keep that unbalanced playing field.
But it's a very, it's not exactly how we think, because it's pitting these companies against each other.
Yes.
So like Comcast is against Meta, you know, like they're not all on one side. They're kind of split with each other.
So give us the primer. Who's where?
Well, the Comcasts of the world, the big, they want not net neutrality. They don't want, they want it to stay the same as it has been for the past several few years. And the Metas of the world, the Netflixes of the world want to keep net neutrality.
And that would be because they don't want Comcast to be giving preferential treatment or, you know, giving the subscription of Peacock for free to Comcast cable and streamers,
right?
Because then Netflix, you have less of a motivation to subscribe to
Netflix. They can charge them extra. They can charge them fees.
So it's the people, I guess the fairest way to say it, it's the people who lack the distribution platform.
Right, that's a good way.
So you have distribution platforms like Comcast who are also producing content, and they would tend, of course, favor their own, as you pointed out. Peacock would be a perfect example. There are other major players, major corporations that just produce content, and they don't have a distribution platform, and they're the ones, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking Amazon in that case, maybe because Prime, but they don't necessarily have the internet service provider function.
They don't own, well, they've created their own distribution network. It's kind of an odd thing because of all their Prime subscribers for their other product, their shopping product.
Okay.
But one of the things that's really interesting that happened in the meantime is we didn't notice a lot of changes, I don't think, in the past few years.
That was going to be my other question.
Yeah,
like, is this even going to mean anything or have a big impact on the surface level to consumers?
The answer is California. I didn't know if you saw that one coming, but...
So, I didn't. I was about to be like, okay.
In the meantime, well, basically this happens. Is, oh, that's funny.
Almost, we're all about music today.
Every technology issue that we're facing right now, the U.S. Congress has not done anything. Shockingly, they've been unable to do that. So basically state laws in Europe are governing everything right now. As California passed its own net neutrality law.
Okay.
And you're thinking, well, that's California, but... First of all, where are all these businesses? A lot of them are based in California, and it's one of the biggest markets in the country. And so these laws, we're dealing with things that cross state lines, so it gets really complicated. Mm-hmm. So a law in California that says you must be net neutral puts a lot of pressure on these people to still be net neutral. So it's almost like a quasi-federal law, and other states have also passed them.
Yeah.
All over, like spotty, all over like New York and all over different country parts of the country. So I think that kind of staved off what we thought would happen when Trump ended net neutrality. But it's not a long-term fix.
Interesting.
But it's something.
Has the EU addressed the issue yet?
I don't know of any net neutrality for EU.
Because they're certainly way ahead of us in terms of the issue we were talking about earlier on safety on the internet and regulation of content on the internet.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see.
Not to put you on the spot, what about Canada? if only because there have been some of these other issues in Canada about access to news through tools like Facebook. That right now a lot of newsrooms, especially nonprofit and scholastic and collegiate newsrooms, are seeing a huge drop-off because of the lack of access to news in Canada.
I don't know about Canada's net neutrality either. That's a great question.
Okay. Well, that's something we can watch too as we continue to see what happens as this becomes a thing again. Either of you watched the show on HBO called Succession?
No. I did not watch any of those, but you're going to be our expert.
But I really only watched the first season, and I don't even know why I didn't go on from there. But it's about a media mogul who's trying to decide who to hand his empire down to among a group of, shall I say, flawed progeny. You don't need HBO to see it, because you can watch it unfold right now in real life, now that Rupert Murdoch has announced that come November, he's stepping down as the chairman of Fox and News Corp and moving into the role of chairman emeritus. The heir apparent at this point is his son, Lachlan. What do you expect that these companies are going to look like, and how is business going to be carried out under Lachlan's leadership?
Well, my guess is it'll be carried out pretty much the same, at least pro tem, because I don't think Rupert Murdoch's really leaving. I think he's made that pretty clear. He's still going to be in the office. He's still going to be there. I have worked for a news organization that was once headed by a very powerful billionaire named Michael Bloomberg, who left to become New York City mayor, and when he came back, just upended everything that had been done while he was gone and put everything back the way he had run it. So I think when you have a really powerful figure like that, who not only he's used to being listened to, but the people in the organization are used to listening to him, I don't think much will change. My read of it was this was his way of trying to solidify the succession for his chosen son, Lachlan. It is going to be a mess as far as I can read it, because when Rupert does exit definitively to the great newsroom in the sky, there is a legal agreement. And I think all of the children, it's kind of jump ball as I read it. So I think maybe he was trying to send a signal. Whether that will ultimately have any real impact, I don't know.
This is somebody whose career has spanned more than seven decades. We're talking 70 years plus. As he is starting to move to the side, if not exit entirely, what kind of legacy is he going to be leaving behind from those 70 years?
When you think of the people in U.S. history who have had the most impact on our media environment, good or bad, he has to be on the list, right? Like,
100%.
Top five even. I mean, our information universe is substantially different because of what he did with Fox News. It's been not necessarily a net gain for democracy, but I mean, it's a completely different game.
Yeah, I think also this was somebody who, I mean, certainly a visionary. He has had a global vision. I mean, he came from Australia, and now he is moving on to he moved on to a world stage. So he is, you know, and then I think the other thing is he moved from print, which really is his first love. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say one thing about that before we go, but it's really his first love to television. And certainly with Fox, he sensed a hunger out there for a different kind of information. He grabbed it. But the other thing that I think is interesting, and this gets to your question, Amy, about what kind of a business is it going to be, he's now trying to re-merge his television properties and his entertainment properties with the newspaper business. And I think that's really interesting, and it's an indication he's a print guy at heart. You can love him or hate him, but Rupert Murdoch cares about newspapers, and he wants his newspapers to survive.
Okay. You know, we're coming up on the end of September, and it has been a year for the staff at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Last September, investigative reporter Jeff Gurman was stabbed to death in retaliation for his reporting, and now another reporter is facing what's being called, quote, a fire hose of hatred on social media over what's really just an outdated headline. Sabrina Schnur was the first journalist on the scene when a former police chief was killed in a hit and run last month. She talked to his family and wrote an obituary that included the voices of his daughter and wife. The headline on that obit read, "Retired police chief killed in bike crash, remembered for laugh and love of coffee." When the story ran, police did not yet know that the killing was intentional. Actually, they didn't know until 13 days after the obit ran, when a source approached Schnur with a video showing the driver in the crash intentionally hitting Probst and laughing about it with a passenger in the car. And Schnur did cover the subsequent murder charge, actually suggesting that that source go to the police and hand over that video. But the internet, and I say that with air quotes, they missed the update on that story. They saw the old one. They didn't see the murder charges. They then thought she dropped the ball. And what's worse, doxed her, filling her inbox and social media feeds with hateful anti-Semitic messages. And to make matters worse, Elon Musk amplifying them.
Yeah, this is why I'm not on X or Twitter. It's this is horrendous. And it is... it's one thing for people to make a mistake, but it's another thing. And this reporter, by the way, I don't mean that. I don't mean the reporter. The people who are criticizing her for a headline that was written long before this information was available made a mistake. But you do not have to be hateful about it. And you do not, I mean, the idea of introducing somebody's identity into this in a hateful way, also the idea that the head of a internet platform is amplifying this, it's just, this is why I think regulation is going to be, the internet platforms are asking to be regulated because this kind of thing is beyond the pale.
It says something about our information universe, doesn't it? I mean, people have always disagreed about facts, and democracy was built for us to disagree about facts. The entire system of free expression was built for that, but something different is happening now where we just can't handle disagreeing. We used to just disagree. Now we're attacking people and harming people.
Well, and I think sometimes in a case like this, we just can't handle a woman in a position of authority. What would cause people to just trigger off that? And I am appalled by the way women particularly are trolled and attacked online, and it's and the internet platforms are just not doing enough about it. That's why Maria Ressa won a Nobel Peace Prize, because she had the guts to call it out.
It does raise that question again about what you were talking about, facts, right? And the idea of having facts, debating facts, and that this isn't about the facts. This is about going to identities alone. And it feels like they say an attack on their free speech. And I hear that, but and it's hard to get into this with just 1 minute left, but is this free speech? I'm going to ask you. I know. And 57 seconds just is not fair.
And you're going to put the music on, too. Okay. Is it, are you saying the harmful speech?
Yeah.
The doxing and that sort of thing? Right now it is.
Okay.
That's just a...
Here's what I'll say. You have a right to your own opinion, but you don't have a right to worldwide publication.
I mean, as of right now, the Supreme Court has said the First Amendment protects their expression.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us, and to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Takiya Thomas for handling our audio today, Tim Pilcher, who composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. I invite you to join us again next week for another edition of Views of the News.